Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Americans prepare to welcome the Pope. We take a look at last-minute preparations and the expectations ahead of this pastoral visit to the USA. And keeping hope alive. Despite the continuing violence in the Gaza Strip, the incoming leader of the Latin Rite Church in Jerusalem speaks of the challenges of promoting peace in the land where Jesus lived. With less than a week to go before the papal plane touches down at Washington DC's Andrews Air Force Base at the start of Pope Benedict's historic visit to America, organizers stateside are putting the finishing touches on preparations which have been underway for months. Catholic bishops have been on the front line preparing people for the visit, providing a wealth of teaching materials in English and Spanish, as well as the more prosaic details about tickets and transportation to papal events. The Bishops' Conference will be providing live streaming of those events on its website, plus a host of other blogs, photos, background information, audio and video files to offer complete coverage to as wide an audience as possible. Catholic schools have been busy with students writing songs, videos, even designing skateboards to welcome the Pope to America. But what will be the main issues on the agenda during the April 15th to 20th pastoral visit to Washington, D.C. and New York? And what kind of welcome is the Catholic community preparing for Pope Benedict, who'll be marking the third anniversary of his pontificate during this trip?
People are very excited, especially those who are going to get into the events. It's not easy. It's the post-9/11 world. Security is unbelievably difficult.
Award-winning journalist David Gibson is a former colleague here at Vatican Radio and author of two books on the American Church and the papacy of Benedict XVI. He now lives and works in Brooklyn, New York, from where he's been keeping a close eye on the build-up to this trip.
Well, there's really a great sense of anticipation, as there is before any papal visit to the United States. Obviously, there's also not just anticipation and enthusiasm, but really there's a great deal of curiosity about who Benedict XVI is. You know, people, you had this kind of media image of him, obviously, for so many years when he was head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And people have a real sense now that they've gotten to see him, at least, you know, remotely through television clips, et cetera, from Rome, that he may not be the man that they thought he was, certainly not as Pope. So there's a real curiosity and, you know, to discover, in a sense, on our own, who he is, what he's like, what he's going to say.
He traveled to the U.S. on several occasions, didn't he, as head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, to meet with bishops and so on. But what kind of welcome, then, do you think he's likely to get from the American people?
His welcome this time around, I think, will be quite warm, probably a good deal different than it was when he came here a few times. I think he visited the United States about five times, all, as you say, for church-related events or academic lectures, things like that. So he hasn't had a lot of on-the-ground experience in the United States, seeing U.S. Catholics kind of up close and personal. And also, many of those visits, a couple of those visits at least, were marked by protests of some of his lectures, that kind of thing, that were related obviously to his role and his reputation as head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. I think his reception is obviously going to be a good deal different this time. People are very excited, especially those who are going to get into the events. It's not easy. It's the post-9/11 world. Security is unbelievably difficult. I know a lot of people, even in my parish, some slightly older people who were really hoping they'd won the lottery for the handful of tickets we had, but they just couldn't fulfill the requirements of getting to the Mass, to it, Yankee Stadium in New York, in this case, in time. So it's real people are looking forward to seeing him in person, I think, above all. There are going to be some protests. Already, I think the American Atheists sent out a press release just yesterday saying they were going to protest the Pope, but I don't know how large a protest that will amount to. The one thing about America is that there aren't that many atheists. It's really The challenge for Benedict is really not so much to convince people to believe in God or even to be Christian, but to answer the question of why they should be Catholic.
That's a very interesting point, isn't it? We heard the ambassador, Marianne Glendon, the ambassador to the Holy See from the States, noting just recently what a large percentage of Americans today are Catholic, and growing numbers of those, of course, are immigrants from Latin America. But tell us a little bit about this Catholic makeup of the States.
Yes, you're right. It's a really, there's both stability and diversity and transformation going on in the church in the United States. Nearly a third of all Catholics are Latinos at this point, many of them, most of them, immigrants, a lot from Mexico. That's the future of the church. I think almost half of Catholics between the ages of, say, 18 and 29, young people, the next, the coming generation, are Latinos already. So there's that transformation going on. But there's also, you know, there's also some falling away on the part of young people on one hand, and also a certain diminishment of the practice of the faith in some of the old line cities. I mean, the part of, in the Northeast, I would say Boston, New York, Philadelphia, that kind of thing, which was really the Catholic heartland for so long. And it's a bit of an irony. Pope Benedict is going to be visiting Washington and New York, which has been traditionally kind of the East Coast bastion of Catholicism. But in a sense, the future of the church is to the South and the West. The demographic trends on all levels, in every category in the United States, are kind of moving that way. And you see that with Catholicism as well, which is why Cardinal DiNardo, Archbishop DiNardo of Houston, was made a cardinal recently. That's a very significant move.
Are you expecting many Catholics from other parts of the country, as you say, the South and the West, to be traveling up to New York and Washington to take part in some of these events?
There will be a good number of various contingents from around. It'll be really small pockets of Catholics from as many dioceses as possible. They really were trying to get as much representation of the entire country because of the fact that Benedict is going just to these two cities and just on the eastern seaboard. It's a difficult thing because you're trying to get a contingent from all over the country, but that means you also have to reduce the number of people locally here in Brooklyn or in Manhattan or in Washington, D.C., Maryland or Virginia that can actually are actually part of the local church that he's visiting.
Now, John Paul II traveled to the U.S., I think it was a total of 7 times. Has there been much talk in the preparation for this trip about the legacy of those visits? And do you think there will be much comparison of Pope Benedict with his predecessor?
Yeah, I think comparisons are inevitable. I mean, I have to make them. Everyone has to make them. They can be invidious comparisons or they can be useful comparisons. I mean, people knew John Paul II and loved him. He was the one who traveled here for 5 really extensive pastoral visits and took the United States by storm. Again, his first visit to the United States came just a year after his election. He went to 7 cities and gave 63 speeches. Benedict XVI is coming to the United States for the first time after 3 years since his election, and he'll be visiting 2 cities and giving, I think, 12 speeches. So there's just a difference already in the amount of energy. John Paul was 58 when he was elected. Benedict XVI was 78 years old when he was elected. But again, some people will be expecting John Paul II in a different guise, or will be disappointed if that's what they don't get. On the other hand, it's very useful to compare the two men to prepare, I think, people for a different style of pontificate and a different style of visit. This is a visit where people are going to have to listen intently. I think Joaquin Navarro-Val said it well when he said of Benedict, this is a pontificate of concepts and words and not great gestures and symbols. There will be those gestures and symbols. He's going to Ground Zero. That's going to be a phenomenal visit. People will be riveted by that, and really by the fact that when he goes to Ground Zero in Lower Manhattan, he's not going to say anything. He's just going to pray silently and meet with some of the relatives of the victims of that terrible tragedy. So there will inevitably be a great deal of theater that surrounds this, and enthusiasm, etc. But people are going to see Benedict as a real teacher, and I think that's going to be effective in its own way.
The words he says, as you say, the speeches are not perhaps quite so easy to portray in the media as these grand gestures, the pictures, the captions and so on. What kind of treatment has the media been giving this trip so far?
Well, I think they've been giving it pretty good treatment. They're trying to cover as many different angles as possible. There have been complaints about it, again, complaining that people are comparing Benedict to John Paul II. Again, I think that's natural. It's a good way to prepare people for the kind of person that Benedict is, to prepare them to listen to what he has to say. But I think, you know, inevitably, it's going to be difficult for both sides, really, because Benedict will present a very, in many respects, complex message that's not easily translated into voice bites. And the media is, you know, going to be looking for a lead that they can write to a story. And the usual suspects of abortion, gay marriage, contraception, genetic testing, things like that, whenever Benedict touches on those issues, those are going to be easy headlines to write and easy things to do. So it's going to be a challenge, I think, for both sides, both for the Vatican and the Pope to present his message and for the media to pick up on that message.
President George W. Bush is welcoming the Pope to the White House. It's only the second time, I believe, that a Pope has ever been to the U.S. president's office. Is that right?
Yeah, it's an It's an interesting kind of quirk of history. I mean, the reason is that the Vatican and the United States didn't have full diplomatic relations until 1984 under John Paul II and President Ronald Reagan. So when Popes, well, I guess Paul VI in 1965, and then John Paul II on his first visit in 1979, they weren't met by the president. The president usually dispatched the first lady or something to go meet them, because you're talking about the president couldn't meet a head of state officially with a state with which the United States did not have diplomatic relations. So it is an interesting kind of quirk of diplomatic history that really this is only the second time that a pope will have visited the White House. And of course, it's a bit problematic. This is the middle of a presidential election year, in case you hadn't noticed. A lot of ink about that, and obviously the Democratic contest between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton is still in full swing. Just there'll be a key, again, presidential primary in Pennsylvania, a very big state, just 2 days after Benedict leaves. So the Holy Father has to navigate these shoals a bit. He's going to go visit a president whose invasion of Iraq was not welcomed by the Vatican or Cardinal Ratzinger himself at all. And he's got to, you know, he wants to get his message about, you know, the just war criteria and respecting international norms and human rights without appearing to show up as host. So it's a very delicate juncture, but it's also an interesting, it'll be one of the more interesting, I think, events.
The first big crowd event comes on Thursday at this new National Stadium in D.C. Can you tell us a little bit more about this venue and who's likely to be there? I think there's quite a star-studded lineup, isn't there?
Yeah, I'd love to tell you more about it, but I've never been there. This will be my first visit there. It just opened a couple of weeks ago when the team in Washington, they're called the Nationals, the baseball team there, started playing. This will be the first non-baseball event at this spanking new stadium. So I'm looking forward to it very much, and I think it's going to be the Pope's first real pastoral event, his first big outdoor event. So I think there's going to be a lot of attention to it. It's also going to have, you know, Placido Domingo, the great opera star, Denise Graves, a whole range of musical and other stars and well-known people. And again, it's going to be a balancing act, as I think this whole visit will be for the Vatican and for the Pope, to both recognize and in a sense, incorporate this very celebrity-strewn culture of America, and to try and tap into the great excitement of this visit, but also at the same time to preserve the solemnity and the fact and that this is a mass being celebrated. This is something that Pope Benedict has always been a bit ambivalent about, are these great outdoor events. I think his preference is really to celebrate the mass inside in a sacred space like a church, and that's just not possible with these kind of events. And so, you know, again, his liturgical preferences need to be balanced out with the realities of having to accommodate tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who want to participate.
And my thanks there to journalist and author David Gibson, whose online blog Benedictions will be following closely the papal trip to America. And of course, here on Vatican Radio, we'll be bringing you all those events and up-to-the-minute coverage of the Pope's meetings in Washington, D.C. and New York. Peoples and three religions marked by daily sufferings and conflict caused by political instability. Every believer, every man and woman of goodwill must act constantly to end that suffering, making this goal an object of their prayer and teaching. Patriarch Michel Sabah, outgoing leader of the Latin Rite Church in Jerusalem, wrote those words more than a month ago as he prepared to step down from the post he has held for the past 20 years. Despite the continuing tensions and violence in the Gaza Strip, Patriarch Sabah spoke of the Church's vital role in continuing to uphold and work for an era of peace and reconciliation between Christians, Muslims, and Jews. It's a vision of hope and faith strongly supported by his designated successor, Bishop Fouad Toile, who will shortly be taking over the difficult task of guiding the ever-diminishing Catholic community in the land where Jesus lived. During his most recent visit here to the Vatican, Bishop Toile sat down with me to discuss the challenges facing his church and renewed international efforts at finding a lasting peace for the region.
Well, according to the position of the Holy Father, we still have hope, and he invites us to have always hope, and we do. Till now, there is not many change in the local level or the local situation, but at least on the international level, there is awareness about the importance of the situation, the importance of a solution to be given to the Holy Land. We are very grateful for all the visits, the pilgrimage coming to the Holy Land. With their presence, these bishops, we had a pilgrimage of all bishop conference of Germany, of Austria, and many others. It gives us the impression that we are not alone in this mission. We are not forgotten. We are not abandoned, thanks God. It means this strong communion with the universal church, with our church sister all in Europe. We receive many helps, many helps. We are grateful. But in the same time, we say we need something more. What we need is a peace. We don't want to survive only, to be beggars with license. Church bigger, begging all the time with rises. I don't like this. It is a kind of humiliation. What we need for the moment is a political horizon. We need timing. We need to know where we are going. Time to finish the wall. Time to finish the checkpoint. Time to start the Palestinian state. Time to finish with our problems with the visa. As you know, the Latin Patriarchate covers Jordan, Palestine, and Israel. The majority of our priests, nuns, schools, families are in Jordan, which means we need this link to Jordan. We need to move with the freedom, with liberty for pastoral work. I don't speak about politics. I leave politics to politicians. But as bishop, we want to move for our pastoral work, and we are handicapped. Handicapped because Israel, till now, doesn't trust everything. Israel follows a politic of fears. And fear is not the best thing to live and to share and so on. So we hope. with the intervention, with the prayer, with the pressure of this international coordination that we had, we hope that with our contact with Israel, there will be more trust between both, so we can do our mission as church in the Holy Land, give to the Holy Land its holiness, and remember that Holy Land has its own world dimension, and we are aware of that, and we want to have all the people freedom to access to the holy places, freedom for the local people, for our Christians, from Bethlehem, from Ramallah, from Galilee, from Jordan, to visit freely the holy city, the holy sites. Till now we have in this grace, this benediction, this joy.
We heard President Bush in the region just very recently again calling for a solution within a very short time frame. How hopeful do you think people in the region are that perhaps this time his words will be translated into some kind of action on the ground?
We are very grateful to Mr. Bush for his visit. We are grateful to the speech of Olmert at the same time. For the first time, President Bush pronounced the word occupation. They never used to use this word. He said, end of the occupation. Even Olmert that we met last time, he said he wants to find a solution within the 2008, between the promises, the good speech, the words, and the reality, daily reality we live on the ground, there is a big gap. We're looking, considering the actual situation, the cities of Palestine separated one from the other, from I don't see how they can do it this year. But it is already agreed that even Olmert and even Bush, they spoke about a solution. They put together Palestinians and Israelis. That's great. Thanks God. We encourage them, we pray for them, we respect their decisions, but we know and they know that from many sides we have obstacles. Obstacles from the Palestinian side, obstacles from the Israeli side, and worse than before. And I think some obstacles in the American side. I don't think that the opposition America want to give this great gift to Bush before he finished his mandate to enter in the history, giving peace in the Holy Land when the situation in Iraq is still the same. So we have opposition from three sides, but we Christians, we never lose hope, and we're still living with dynamism, with optimism, with joy. Joy to live, to work, to do our work. We are not desperate and never be desperate. We have many, many good signs in the Holy Land that gives us this joy to live, to work. We have our seminary full of seminarians. We have many pilgrims. We have many friends. We are not alone. Thanks God.
Looking on the Palestinian side, of course, the problems between Hamas and Fatah, many people see this as a crucial stumbling block to negotiations with Israel. Do you agree with that? And how do you think perhaps you can help to resolve these internal problems?
No. Look, now in all the Middle East, and especially in Palestine, we are living this big crisis. So within this big crisis, we have small crisis. We must understand that. I don't think that it's the moment to put them together, the two divisions from the Palestinians. Not the moment. Otherwise, that will be a pretext for Israel. We don't deal with terrorists. Now Israel has no more pretext. But for the moment, it is not the time to put them together. But I am sure, one day they must gather. And we have to remember that all the Arab League is behind pushing both of them together. And one day they will gather. They are Palestinians, they are Muslims, they are Arabs. They have all the elements to be together. Now the situation is very complicated, and we will have small problems here and there. But I hope we are happy to see both now Israelis and Palestinians are gathering to dialogue to find a solution. You have to remember and let Israel remember for whom we wish peace and security, that they tried all the means. Till now they won all the wars, or almost all the wars with their neighbors. Till now they never won peace and security. Let us try something else. Let us try dialogue. Let us try trust, more trust. Let us try to respect the international resolution. Let us do something else. And we hope that everybody will enjoy and peace and security.
You do have relationships with the Jewish, with the Muslim leaders in the region, don't you?
Yes.
How can, do you think, dialogue amongst purely, at a purely religious level, how can this influence any further the political dialogue?
I don't know, really, I don't know. And we know that without a political decisions, we can only speak, we can meet, we can pray. But without the political effort, decisions, we can do nothing. It is only on the still on the level of religious leaders. We have what we call interfaith council, and we meet each 2, 3, 4 months. It is okay. It is nice. We have to start from there and try to influence our people, Muslims, Jews, and the Christians. But if you speak about any dialogue between the people, or population, Palestinian and Israel, well, I can say that in the state of Israel, they can meet. They have some friendship, some relations, and so on. But in the occupied territories, the Jews that we meet are only the soldiers and the settlers. And I don't think any dialogue can be possible with the soldiers on the checkpoints and with the settlers. I don't think so. I wish, but I'm sure for the moment we have no dialogue with them.
Patriarch Sabah speaks about the mystery of being a Christian, living the Christian faith in the Holy Land. Can you explain a little further that idea?
We must accept not to understand. That's the mystery. Why since 50 years, 60 years, despite all the efforts, we haven't peace? Why? I think that's the city, Jerusalem, for me personally, is the city where the Lord walked and suffered and died. And we cannot work in the Holy Land. We cannot love the Holy Land without this mystery of cross and all these problems, our suffering brings us back to the gospel. And we have to take ad literam the words of the Lord when he said, if anybody wishes to follow me, he must take his cross, bear his cross and follow me. We are bearing our cross. That's our daily bread. That's the mystery of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is with the cross. There is no Jerusalem without any cross. Since the time of the Lord till now, we have our cross. But we know that at the same time that the Lord had at the end his resurrection. The Lord said in the same time, don't be afraid, I will be with you all the time. So remember his words to bear our cross. We remember his words to be courageous, to have faith.
And my thanks there to Bishop Fouad Toual, designated successor to Patriarch Michel Sabah, leader of the Latin Rite Church in Jerusalem. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.